This is Nancy and Kim Brown. We're talking about Liber lineup updates of Unfiltered Insights, and we are covering the last AASLD meeting in 2025. We're going to talk about viral hepatitis. Now, there was lots of messaging in viral hepatitis that are important concepts. So I'm not going to get into some of the granular details of some of these abstracts. Some of them, I will spend a little bit more time. But I think one of the most important things is viral hepatitis is no longer sexy. I don't know about you, Kim, but, you know, people are really not saying, oh, hey, what did they talk about for hep C? Because most people think that hep C is a done disease, right? We have a highly effective curative treatment. We have really, really, excellent diagnostic tools. But it is really important to emphasize that we are not applying them, and not just here in the United States, but globally. There are very few places on track for any of the WHO outlined curative or global elimination, metrics. And so one of the abstracts that was presented was just, again, elimination targets. This is usually a really nice cooperative between the WHO and the CDC observatory data that, again, reminds us that do not forget about viral hepatitis. These are diseases that can be cured or nicely controlled, and we are not doing that yet. How about you, Kim? Are you guys, have you eliminated, the hepatitis B and C from the Henry Ford health system?
You know, it's interesting. First of all, the answer is no. What was interesting, though, is that years ago, we did eliminate it from our dialysis population. We have a closed patient population of several dialysis units, and I implemented a strategy to eliminate it in that population, but it required universal testing, and it required universal testing without the input from the referring physician, because we found that was a huge barrier trying to get them to act on something. So basically, if a patient was identified as positive, we went in and treated them. So we controlled the disease in large part by basically reaching out to patients. So I think right? The biggest barrier is just identifying the patient. It is usually in the hands of primary care or not us, right? But we're the treaters, so.
No, absolutely. And the same is true with us. We have some very nice screening programs in high-risk populations like our emergency room or urgent care. And we find that linkage, the patients are often very agreeable, but then when they're found, we reach out. It's challenging to link someone that was an ER patient just because they're not established. And then, like you said, it's primary care often not doing the screening. And I know that this is a bit of my own soapbox, but it's very frustrating for me when someone is referred for abnormal liver enzymes and I go back and cannot find hepatitis B and C testing. Now, granted, those are not the most common reasons for abnormal liver enzymes, but it really suggests that you put zero thought into why your patient might have abnormal liver enzymes, or maybe you were thinking about it and you assumed it was a drug or metabolic dysfunction related liver disease, but you still didn't even do the standard screening that the CDC and everyone still advocates for. And most of our primary care colleagues are busy, are excellent. They are amazing physicians, and I could not do primary care. But, we are still missing a lot of screening.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I think we've gotten better at our institution. Everybody who I see with elevated LFTs do have a B and C screen. Okay.
Good job.
And they turn out to be, massive. But
yes,
that's another topic, I guess.
All right. So the next thing is we are always looking for preventative measures. And there was a really interesting abstract that was presented on patients who had hepatitis B and were using statins for indications for statins. So it's not like these individuals got statins as a preventative measure, but they probably had hyperlipidemia or cardiovascular risk and were given a statin. So Korea has a really interesting way of capturing data. They have a national health system that really is very, very comprehensive. And this study in a large group of individuals, 37,000 statin users, as opposed to 2,845 non-users, really showed that the statin use was associated with a reduced risk of liver cancer in patients with hepatitis B. They also showed that statin use was associated with a lower risk of hepatic decompensation. And so this is, I think, also really important because one of the main reasons I see patients not on a statin is because they have abnormal liver enzymes or liver disease. And you know, I think there is a cautionary tale in a decompensated cirrhotic. So in your patient who has refractory ascites and high MELD, it might not be the moment for their statin at that time. But we do, we have one more reminder to not be afraid of using a statin in an appropriate patient, even if they have compensated cirrhosis. Are you finding the same thing, Kim?
We are. We actually just submitted some of our own data on Hep C. Originally, we were really looking at the ability of antiviral therapy to prevent decompensation, in our patient population, but interestingly found that statin use, very similar to what you're seeing in the literature, was associated with less risk of progression and also less risk of decompensation in our Hep C population. It's interesting because I wonder the mechanism, right? Is it truly acting as an antifibrotic, or is the mechanism really through reduction of steatosis and the associated risk with elevated lipids? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I know that statins do have more, they're not great at reducing steatosis, at least by imaging. So that, before we had resmetirom and, GLP-1s and other agents that were really good at defatting a liver, I wouldn't say we would try to use statins, but if you had hyperlipidemia, we would use them. And I don't remember ever seeing people whose numbers improved, that their steatosis seemed to decrease. So maybe it's some other anti-inflammatory effect. I'm not sure. But like you said, with your Hep C population, in this Korean cohort, this was independent of antiviral therapy. So I would have expected that patients who had treated Hep B would have, would have a stronger impact from their antiviral than their statin. But they didn't find that. They found that the statin may have been more impactful than the antiviral therapy. And I think before we go around and say, don't treat your Hep B, just give a statin, this has to be more carefully looked at. But, I look at this and say, don't be afraid of your statin. These were all patients that deserved a statin. They were not using statin therapy in individuals that did not have otherwise appropriate indications. And, we are going to need other data to really show that patients that do not need a statin should have a statin used as a preventative therapy for risk of decompensation in HCC.
Yeah. No, it's... I think we're back to the same days as when we were trying to decide if somebody without diabetes should get metformin, right?
Yes.
but yeah, I'm very pro statins in our patients.
Talking about preventative things in GLP-1s and steatosis, this was looking at data in patients who had hepatitis B or hepatitis C that were also on a GLP-1. And, I think there has been controversy. Some data had suggested that using a GLP-1 decreased many obesity-associated malignancies in addition to the metabolic effects that you would expect from your GLP-1. And then I think there was a little data that suggested that that may not be true, that you cannot just give a GLP-1 and expect that your breast cancer and pancreatic cancer and your colorectal cancer risk was going to go down, that you might have to still think about your overall health decisions. But this was a really big data base and a U.S. marketing cohort that looked at 250 million Americans and looked at those that had hepatitis B or hepatitis C with predominantly type 2 diabetes and GLP-1 use, and looked at those other health-associated complications, and really demonstrated, at least in this group, that GLP-1 use, again, appropriately for another indication, not to, you know, use it as an anti-cancer therapy, but it had very beneficial effects. So this is looking at multiple, metrics in those individuals, and that showed that liver-related outcomes were improved. And those that got GLP-1, liver cancer rates were improved. Cirrhosis progression, cirrhosis decompensation, and then the things that you would expect, like cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, that we know with those GLP-1s. But non-liver-related cancer also decreased. So I know that this continues to be controversial, but a little bit like our statin messages, if you have a reason to be on a GLP-1, it is probably going to be liver favorable along with metabolically favorable. And if your metabolic parameters are improved, you're probably going to have an improvement in metabolic associated non-liver related cancers as well as HCC. So do not be afraid of your GLP-1.
Yeah, I just find this class of drugs to be incredibly fascinating. We've recognized for a long time that obesity is an inflammatory condition and highly associated with increased risk of many types of cancers. And it is just amazing to me. I wonder, right? I can't imagine that the human population now has less GLP-1 in their body than they did before genetically, right? Is it, you know, what's driving this? Is it all our dietary changes? These drugs are, one of the things that I worried about is that as more people use them, would you see increased risk of some kind of weird cancer or some kind of disease? But in fact, it's kind of showing the opposite. It seems to be promotes health in many, many ways.
I also think that this data helps reassure us because, I have patients that come in and say, oh, these medicines cause thyroid cancer, they cause pancreatitis or pancreatic cancer. And there are patients that you have to be very cautionary with. And I don't know if you are prescribing GLP-1s, but we've been proactively using them in our patients now that semaglutide is approved for at-risk MASLD. We probably even have more use. And the two things I ask about, besides MAN syndrome, is about depression, because there is an association with, suicidal ideation in individuals who are at risk for suicidal ideation. I've not seen them cause depression in a person who did not have underlying depression. And then I ask about symptomatic cholelithiasis, because they can worsen cholelithiasis or make cholelithiasis symptomatic. And again, that's a common thing. People that are not on GLP-1s can get symptomatic cholelithiasis, especially if they're obese or are intermittently fasting or have other reasons to get gallstones. But none of this data is showing a signal of thyroid cancer or pancreatic cancer or pancreatitis. And so I think it helps to add to the safety profile in addition to the benefit.
Yeah, no, I agree. Lots of data coming out on these.
Yes. Now, I just wanted to spend a little tiny bit of time, because we have a huge avalanche of potential therapies for hepatitis B and Delta. We talk a lot about functional cure, which is a definition I think most of us do not like, but the implication of functional cure is that you're able to stop all of your antiviral therapy and your hepatitis is not necessarily gone from your system, but is not replicating. And hopefully you have a loss or at least an improvement in your hepatitis B surface antigen levels. One of the agents that we do expect to get is bepirovirsen, or Bepi. This is a ASO, and it is used probably by itself. But one of the studies that looked at it looked at Bepi use with subsequent pegylated interferon. And I think most of us are not excited to use peg interferon. But Durability is what this study is really looking at. Not, you know, it's already been presented the efficacy of this, which is not zero, not amazing, but not zero. But you want to make sure that whatever you get stays. And when you're looking at an arbitrary definition like functional cure, which means 6 months after we've stopped, things still look good. What if everything does poorly in 9 months or 12 months? And so this study really was focusing on the individuals that were in B together that then went over into a longer term trial to see if the efficacy, which is their Hep B was controlled, their Hep B surface antigen might have declined, and if that was durable. And it was nice to see that what they did get seemed to be durable in most patients. And so, you know, I think that this was also independent of pegylated interferon. I don't think that the peg was the answer. I think the individuals that responded had durability irrespective of whether they had a subsequent treatment of exposure to peg. And as a reminder, that the overall response was relatively small, I think 8 to 9% in the original cohort. But if you picked people by baseline Hep B surface antigen, then the efficacy of the agent was much better. And so I think, you know, I'll be interested to hear what you think, Kim, but I would not say that Bepi is going to be a good choice for the majority of our Hep B patients. But I think if you have a Hep B patient who has low baseline surface antigen, is willing to take an agent, knowing that there might be a chance for them to stop their nucleotide or nucleoside and have functional cure, this is going to be an option for them. But, you know, I think it's still going to require a lot of close observation because not everyone had sustainable response and not everyone, you know, was going to be a good candidate in the first place.
Yeah, no, I agree. I see this as one of the, this is true for all therapies, right? The ones that come the earliest have some response, and then as we learn more, we get better and better and better. I agree with you though, especially since we are now, I think, becoming more inclusive of who we treat for hepatitis B. So if that is the case, and we're treating more and more patients, leaving more and more patients on therapy for the remainder of their life is one thing. If we can identify those patients that can stop therapy, both for economics, but ease of convenience, et cetera, in a safe manner, right? So I do think you're right. This is not the end all be all. This isn't the answer for everybody, but I do think it shows proof of concept that we can achieve something like this with certain therapies in a patient population that, again, currently we just leave on treatment forever, right? So I find this to be very encouraging data.
Yeah, and I think that durability is one thing, and it will be followed by whether this leads to decreased risk of progression of disease and liver cancer. Because remember, we treat our Hep B patients not to control the virus, but to manage long-term consequences, such as extrahepatic manifestations of Hep B, HCC, transmission. But there's not been a study yet, whether it's looking at antiviral therapy, pegylated interferon, that showed that reducing or controlling virus or eliminating Hep B surface antigen was not associated with a good long-term outcome. But we still need that data for these newer agents.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That's always the question that we have, right? Does a functional cure, as achieved through these types of strategies, equate to similar long-term outcomes as to somebody who loses surface antigen naturally?
Right. And remember, nucleotides and nucleosides are safe. I mean, the reason that it's going to be such a challenge to get a new treatment is because our current therapy is so effective. But I have had, you know, one or two patients a year that have very significant reactivation of their Hep B when they stop their nucleotide or nucleoside. And they don't, you know, sometimes they stop because we've decided to stop them and watch them. Sometimes they stop because they lost insurance. or, you know, they moved and didn't establish with a new provider and were unable to get their therapy. And so if you have an opportunity to have a functional cure that does not require an agent, that's going to be a great choice for some patients.
Yeah. No, I agree.
We all recognize that hepatitis B with hepatitis D infection is one of the most severe viruses that a liver can host. The rates of cirrhosis and liver cancer are much higher and at an earlier age. And so when we look at these clinical trials or the patients in our clinic, if you have replicating D, the average age of these individuals in these studies is usually about a decade younger than a Hep B mono-infected. And the percentage of patients with cirrhosis is usually about 50% compared to about 15 to 20% in the Hep B mono-infected population. And so we really need effective therapies for Delta. There, one of the strategies is a combination of a monoclonal antibody and an siRNA. That's tobevibart and elebsiran. This is the VIR data, and they presented very exciting information at AASLD. So the strategy is the monoclonal antibody is not just a entry inhibitor, but also has some, immunologic mechanisms. And then your siRNA is really reducing your hepatitis B RNA. And when you combine these in a group of individuals with hepatitis B surface antigen and Hep D replication, these were very effective in controlling the virus in the majority of the patients. So if you assign value in losing or decreasing your hepatitis D RNA, which is, I think, what we would want out of an antiviral strategy, this therapy resulted in hepatitis D RNA undetectability in about half of the individuals, 49% in those that got the monoclonal antibody alone, and 66% in those that got the combination of the siRNA and monoclonal antibody. But equally important, a 2-log decrease in RNA, which was traditionally our metric of success based on previous trials, was 97% in the combination therapy and 79% in the monoclonal antibody alone. And that is looking at 48 weeks. And we hope that this will be durable. Of course, we still need more data. But I think that this is, pretty substantial given the severity of the disease and the fact that we don't, in the U.S., have any approved treatment. Worldwide, we have just bulevirtide, which, is a great agent for some patients, but did not lead to this degree of hepatitis D response at 48 weeks. So we're keeping a close eye on this combination of drugs. Do you have patients with D in your clinic, Kim?
So I find this data interesting. Just had a patient from Pakistan who came into care, had been on treatment for hepatitis B, so had hepatitis B suppressed. I checked her for Delta, and she replicates. So submitted to her insurance company request for pegylated interferon, and it was denied. So so there you go. Now. Wow. Yeah, it's very interesting. I my guess is we have to appeal. My guess is they probably don't understand Delta. They probably see it very rarely, and probably I had to look up how to order interferon because it's been so long. But yeah, I think it is important. We don't see a lot of patients. I know you see more in the Chicago area than we do in Detroit, but. Just had one pop into our clinic. So,
It's been a long time since we've ordered pegylated interferon outside of a clinical trial. So I would also struggle with having to get it ordered. And, for anyone listening that has a Delta patient that needs treatment, you can get early access to bulevirtide. I believe that Gilead still has that program. And I think we expect bulevirtide approval in 2026. So there will be options. But, just like we said with Bepi, the first to market, I guess you could say PEG is our first, but early treatment is, is going to be replaced by better therapy. And that doesn't mean that the early option is a bad option. It just means that just like the iPhone 4, you don't want to keep that for the rest of your life. Our quest in science is to make things better. And there are some attractive strategies suggesting that there will be better things for Delta down the road, which takes us to the next study I wanted to cover, which is a little bit on durability. So like we've discussed for other things, you want to know that your treatment is going to work. And if it has to be a long-term, option, who needs that long-term option compared to who might be able to stop. And bulevirtide, we have the most data with. And I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about bulevirtide because this is something that has been presented over and over between EASL and AASLD for the last several years. But the registrational trials for bulevirtide did include multiple doses of bulevirtide, 2 milligrams versus 10 milligrams. And some of the individuals had monotherapy and some of the individuals had pegylated interferon exposure. So most of the patients are not going to be considered for pegylated interferon, although it is a good strategy for a person who's got very well compensated cirrhosis or not cirrhotic at all. But the clinical trial did end treatment. And it was really important to know what happened to these patients. And so a lot of patients that stopped their bulevirtide had replication. And they looked at those that had either sustained response or had a low viremic relapse, which means that they replicated, but they replicated at a lower level from where they started, or if they had high virologic relapse, which means they really went back to kind of where they started. And when you look at this data, and it kind of, it goes over time, because you can imagine right after stopping therapy, there might be a little less relapse as opposed to, several weeks to months after you've stopped therapy. But the good news was a significant group of these individuals really had sustained undetectable hepatitis D, which means that some of your patients that are going to be able to stop therapy may not ever replicate. And that's exciting, but it's not the majority. And they didn't really find that there was a difference between those that had a high viremic relapse and those that had a low viremic relapse. And most patients that relapsed kind of had that high viremic response. And so we are going to learn more. The hope is that we will identify patients that might be able to stop therapy with a durable outcome at an earlier time point so that you would not have to stop someone who was much more likely to relapse. But if you do identify a patient or you want to try a patient off treatment with careful observation, some of those individuals are going to have a durable response after exposure to bulevirtide with or without pegylated interferon.
Yeah. Have you utilized the early access program? Have you utilized bulevirtide? And then what dose have you used, the 2 or the 10?
Yeah, so I have a patient in the early access program, but she was in the compassionate use program. So she's on 2 milligrams and she was decompensated. They had to be mildly decompensated. And because of that, we have not stopped her. She's remained on bulevirtide and hoping to get approval of the therapy. And then I think that the anticipated dose for approval will be 10 milligrams. I do not have anyone in the compassionate or that my patients in the compassionate use. I don't have anyone in the early access, but a couple of my colleagues do. And I think that, my patient's doing quite well. She's recompensated. She had presented with a little bit of ascites and some mild encephalopathy, and those are all better. Unfortunately, we're now watching a very early liver cancer, and so she's probably going to need to go towards transplant down the road. But I think that the bulevirtide has offered an opportunity to stay healthy while we, look at, unfortunately, long-term strategies that may not be just focused on controlling her virus.
Yeah. That's an interesting case because you see all the time in our patients who are decompensated with B, once you control viremia, they often recompensate. And so it sounds like your patient did something similar with control of her Delta.
Yeah, absolutely. It just isn't, it's not controlling all the things that Delta is causing, but it's definitely helping her to be healthier.